from a pizza-by-the-slice map of New York City to the amber-hued pleasures of craft beer, capturing food and drink on the page is something of an art form. What are the key ingredients to appeal to the voracious food lover's reading appetites? We'll sample all the delights on offer today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, coming up today.
I brought along a beer from Sweden that we imported from there, from Kapp Brewery over in Sweden. They are a really fantastic brewery.
That sounds not getting any less good each time it happens.
It actually sounds like a sort of Foley. Doesn't really sound real.
We'll meet two editors behind titles dedicated to exploring the pleasures of fine food and delicious drink in print. We might even find time for a cheeky drop or two en route. It's early, but who's counting? Also ahead...
I feel like everyone is releasing salad books now. Just look at that book. It's by David Bess, who's this Italian. He gained a bit of weight and decided to create a salad lunch for himself for 1 year.
The unmistakable man behind the menu here on Monocle 24, Marco Sippi, will join me for a look through some of his favourite foodie and recipe books, seeing as we're talking about the art of food on the printed page. All that and more ahead here on The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Now, there was a time when food magazines seemed to be a little limited. The selection was basic, to say the least, but as we are celebrating so often on this very programme, we're in the midst of something of a golden age in the magazine world, and the food genre is very much a key part of that. Here with me, David Lane from The Gourmand, an old friend of ours, back on the show once again, and a debut for Fraser Doherty from Ferment magazine, all about craft beer. And Fraser, I mean, that's maybe a good jumping off point. Tell us a bit about the genesis, if you like, of Ferment, because obviously you're sort of coming at this from a perspective of someone who's launched a craft beer, I don't know what you'd call it. Well, it's a service, a provision,
exactly.
And the magazine's a tie-in. Why did you decide to take the beer into print, if you like?
Sure. So we started out maybe 3 years ago. My friend James Brown and I, we kind of had a love of craft beer, and we thought, wouldn't it be great to make a club where every month we could send out a box of 8 different beers from around the world? And we kind of didn't know if it would work, but we started it. And over the past 3 years, maybe 100,000 people have kind of joined us on this craft beer drinking adventure.
That's a good healthy number.
Ever since we started, we kind of put tasting notes in the box, and then we thought it would be great to tell the stories of the breweries and then maybe put some recipes in there. And it started out maybe a 12-page flyer in the boxes, and then it's sort of grown and grown and evolved over time into now a 100-page long, fully produced magazine, which, as well as going into our boxes, we are kind of selling in a couple thousand stores.
And tell me about that. Is it just the thing where you said, actually, you know, this would kind of almost be better as a magazine? Or was there something about having a magazine as well, that, because I mean, this is what we often talk about on The Stack, there's a certain allure, there's something pleasant about, you know, the written word on the page as well, to work with journalists and illustrators, photographers, this kind of thing. Was that an appeal beyond it merely being a sort of a practical device, if you like?
Sure. So I guess, like, our model is a subscription, so our customers pay, you know, every month, and we send them a box of beer. And magazines is kind of the original subscription model. People kind of look forward to what the theme of the next edition is going to be. So I think this idea of, like, creating an event when the box arrives, so it's not just a random selection of beers in a box, it's a whole theme with stories and recipes and this kind of content that brings it to life. And our members love learning about these places that we've been and the breweries that we've met, and, you know, there's like incredible stories of some of the kind of wacky people who make beer.
And David, you must be quite impressed, because there's a new one of these every month, so they're jumping in at the deep end.
Yeah, it's an amazing undertaking, but I think the best thing about it is, like you said, you've got this brilliant guaranteed audience.
True.
And that's really what a lot of magazines don't have, so to have that from the beginning and then allow you to make 100,000 magazines every month is fantastic.
And let's talk a little bit about, obviously we've talked often before about The Gourmand and its sort of its genesis and its origin and the journey, I guess, that it's still on, because that's always an interesting process. But maybe remind us about the idea of, you know, food and drink in print. Why was that something that kind of spoke to you, if you like, beyond anything else?
I think first of all, it's really the most universal thing. Every single person in the world eats and drinks, and it's the moment that we sit down and stop working and discuss things with friends and have ideas and talk about things. So we just felt that all things considered, the way it was represented in the media a lot of the time was quite narrow, you know. It was really just showing the actual food and drink end of it rather than all the cultural space around it. So we started the publication to talk about that and really talk about art and music and film and all sorts of different things, literature, through the medium of food.
And how they feed into one another, if you'll forgive the pardon.
Definitely.
Tell me a little bit, Fraser, about that, because obviously beer and certainly craft beer and the consumption, well, in fact, the development of a lot of these smaller brews, they're often much smaller.
Exactly.
They're more social. And we have these stories often, we talk to David and again at Monocle about the provenance of food or the provenance of drink.
Absolutely.
But it's kind of inherently social. And I guess some of the stories you've picked out, particularly, you know, obviously in Copenhagen in this first issue, sure, the people are what make great beer,
yeah,
isn't it? Even
exactly.
Even sort of before the ingredients, almost.
That's it. Yeah, like we could have done a magazine about beer where we just cover to cover review beers, and that would be boring as hell.
I would still probably read it just to declare my interest. But
as you say, the thing that's exciting about it are some of the characters who are brewing the beer, the places that they're brewing them in. Mm. So for our first edition, we visited Copenhagen. We interviewed Mikkeller, who's kind of one of our beer heroes. He's sort of the Walter White of craft beer.
I've read that in there. I thought that was rather good. And this is because there's a sort of quite literally a chemistry, a scientific background.
Yeah.
But as well as an appreciation that it doesn't work if it doesn't have great bottle design,
sure,
if it's not, you're not in a great location when you're consuming it. You've
exactly.
got to have a knowledge of all of these disparate parts, I guess.
That's it, yeah. You know, he was a chemistry teacher. He kind of, in Denmark, managed to convince the school to buy homebrew kits to teach the kids how to brew beer.
Pretty sure that wouldn't happen in this country, but who knows?
And then he ends up leaving his job as a teacher and starting Mikkeller, becomes one of the most famous brewers, creates like 600 iconic beers. And then a couple of his students left school and they started another brand called To'ol. And so in our box this month, we've got some great beers by the teacher and from the students, and they are, you know, some of the best beers in the world.
Literally the master and the student. Well, this seems an apposite juncture.
Perfect. I thought you'd never ask.
We have a selection from, so tell us, this is from this month's edition. Where should
exactly.
we start? And I'm always mindful, you don't want to start with anything too robust.
Sure.
That's my personal preference.
I guess a great one would be Mikkeller. So he has a Vesterbro Pils. Vesterbro is the kind of area of Copenhagen where he comes from. And it's a very refreshing sort of lager style beer. But he's kind of famous for creating...
We can't capture this. We don't have a webcam, so we can't capture how excited David Lane from the Gourmand is at this moment. But let's
I went out for the first time in quite a long time last night, and I think this is going to aid my
concentration.
Okay, so this is one of the Mikkeller brews.
Exactly. But he's famous for having created 600 different beers, all kinds of different styles, very experimental.
Mm.
He's kind of a gypsy brewer, so he doesn't actually have his own brewery. He kind of works with other breweries, mostly in Belgium. So this beer was created by him in Copenhagen, but is brewed in Belgium.
And tell me a little bit about how this appeared then in print, because there's some interesting pieces. You've got some... So, well, we should say, of course, that the actual cover, if I'm not mistaken, is
exactly.
by... Is this the art director of the brewery?
Yeah, so Keith Shore is an American, but he has a very Scandinavian style of illustration, and he is Mikkeller's art director, so he designed the cover for us. We love having like an illustrated cover every month that focuses on the place that we've gone to. And so we interviewed him about how important label design is in beer, and that is kind of a whole topic, I guess. We also spent a day with Mikkeller, so we kind of met up with him. We thought we'd maybe get like 20 minutes to interview him, but we really hit it off. We ended up, I think we met him midday and we left him about 2 a.m.
A couple of days later, we didn't really remember. It always strikes me as interesting. I mentioned before about people being at the heart of this. And David, I guess it's a similar experience for you with the Gourmand, or perhaps not. Because of that, the sort of the humanity that you talked about, that this most natural thing to eat and to drink often together, do you think that contributors are more sociable, probably thinking of some that perhaps aren't, but people are more willing to open up? I don't know, it's the same throughout the world, you know.
Definitely.
Chefs, they're often very much more sharey with their interests. Does that all filter back to how social food and drink is?
Yeah, I think it definitely doesn't. I mean, first of all, generally people that are interesting in whatever field are also interested in food and drink. I find, you know, if you're into consuming interesting culture, you're also into consuming interesting beer and interesting food and things.
Sometimes at the same time, if possible.
Always at the same time. Yeah, I think as well, when we speak to people, you know, why would they speak to a magazine if they're, you know, incredibly famous or have lots of interviews to do? As soon as you say, actually, can we talk to you about food or the cookbook you wrote about barbecuing in the 70s or something. People do then talk to you about it, and inevitably they end up talking about everything else as well.
Yep.
And if you can have that conversation over dinner or a drink too, it's even better.
I mean, I was going to ask you about that actually, Fred, because obviously, you know, the craft beer movement is, well, it's kind of gone beyond just being a movement or a niche thing now. It, it is everywhere.
Absolutely.
We're in a lucky position, obviously sitting in London, but most places you go now, there'll be a bit of a scene or there'll be some scenesters who can tell you about, oh, I know someone is doing something really exciting. Do you worry about that? Is that just good news because it increases the chance of getting a great beer wherever you go? Do you worry that sort of reaching a point where now everyone thinks they're a home brewer and is, you know, trying to rustle something up in their shed in their back garden? Where is the kind of scene at, do you think?
I think craft beer has really just scratched the surface. I've got friends my age who have kind of heard of BrewDog or have maybe tried craft beer once or twice. And I think that it's something that maybe people have been intimidated by in the way that people can be intimidated by wine in the past. But our whole idea for Beer 52 is like we want to make it very accessible, something that's not pretentious. You know, beer is not wine. It is a serious product, and there's a lot of skill that goes into making great beers, but it's something that's fun. You know, drinking beer is fun and it should be delicious. So
it should be. This is certainly delicious. I'm going to be primed to move on to our next sampler.
Great.
Are we ready for that?
Absolutely.
Where should we head next?
One of our writers went over to Chimay in Belgium. Most of the edition was about Denmark, but we do love Belgian beer, so we visited the
Monks. It would almost be rude not to with Belgian beers.
So this is brewed by monks. There's 12 monks live in an abbey, and they've been brewing beer for hundreds of years, and they've really kind of perfected this recipe. So it's quite light for a Trappist beer. They're normally known to be heavier than that, so it's quite special beer.
Let's have a look. And there was often, and I don't know if this is the case, they're often rather discriminating. They wouldn't be that ready to share some of their innermost secrets. Is this one of these kind of later to be revealed variants?
They sort of come up with a classic and they run with it for, you know, 100 years.
Well, they got time on their side, I guess.
And definitely, you know, Belgians take beer very seriously, and you should, you know, serve it in the right glass and that sort of thing. And we tried to sort of educate people a little bit about, you know, how they can get the most out of drinking beer at home by using the right glassware or pairing it with the right food.
And David, tell me. Oh, that's also excellent.
It's very good, isn't it?
What about that point? We touched on it with Fraser a minute ago there about kind of accessibility. How do you, in publishing terms, look at that with the Gourmand? Because obviously your people who know that your magazine, it's very, very beautiful, always beautiful photography. It's not necessarily the most sort of accessible magazine. You know, often it's quite striking. It can be quite visually almost challenging at times, which is part of its appeal. Is that a consideration for you about how easy to consume it is? Or are you just interested in stuff that looks great, you know, great writing, and then if people kind of can keep up, that's fine. But if not, you don't worry about kind of challenging them a little?
I think there's, within the space of food and drink publishing, there's space for all sorts of different people doing different things. And I think the sort of very accessible food and drink publishing space, there's quite a lot there. And for us to do the same thing would not necessarily be best use of our time. But having said that, you know, we're always really interested when different people get in touch that you wouldn't maybe necessarily normally think. Or you get press in areas that you might not. I mean, we're not ever trying to make something that is hard to digest, you know.
No.
We're never intentionally doing it. We just want to make the best quality thing we can do.
And some of your best cat-based features speak strongly to that.
Exactly.
But what about in terms of even things like, it's funny, obviously.
And dog-based.
Exactly.
The internet. That's very accessible.
Exactly. Sometimes at Monocle it's a question of, oh, you know, which section does Monocle sit in? You know, is it in the, you know, affairs section? Is it in business? Is it in design? Is that a thought that you have? It's not really, it's not a consumer food and drink title necessarily.
No.
But is that quite a nice space in a way to work in?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we've got the luxury of not having a client and not being owned by anyone, so we don't have to make these compromises. And we also have the luxury of it not being a business that, you know, it has to be self-sustainable, but it's never going to be the income for everybody involved in it. We don't sell loads and loads and loads of advertising, and like your business model is different, and every independent magazine now has a different business model. It means we don't have to compromise and we don't have to do those kind of things. I mean, we're just not really interested in doing anything that anyone's done before, and if that makes it a little bit more challenging, then so be it.
So be it, and let's crack open another couple of beers. Fraser, it's interesting that point, though, about business models. How do you see this going? Is it the kind of thing where if the magazine takes a life of its own, that could be spun out, maybe even into markets where the sort of home delivery offer isn't available yet? Or absolutely, is the idea that everything goes international? What's the medium-term future?
Definitely. We have readers in America and in other countries where we don't sell Beer 52. But I guess the idea is that if somebody walks into our newsagent, they pick up our magazine, they maybe have an interest in craft beer, and then this kind of engages them more, then hopefully they'll kind of join the club and get the full experience of getting the magazine and the beers to drink along with them.
And what do you think in terms of your approach? I mean, clearly we mentioned this sort of Copenhagen focus, but it drifts off here and there into some other markets as well. Will it be part and parcel? I don't know if I can give away that you'll be in London next. Is that fair enough to say?
Absolutely.
Where next? Will it be a global tour?
Yeah, we love the idea of travel. And I think one of the interesting thing about beer is that every country has different styles. And, you know, partly exploring that is a lot of fun. So after London, we're going to Scotland and Colorado. We're going over there and drinking beer in the sun. That's kind of a tough job, but someone has to do it. And we'd love to go to all kinds of other places too.
Wonderful. We'll be watching closely. David, what about when the ongoing quest then for inspiration? Obviously, we talked before about things that, you know, jump off newsstand. Maybe you've been a bit sidetracked with the whole child rearing thing recently. It's harder to keep abreast of what's happening. But do you find that where you get your inspiration from changes and shifts? I mean, I don't know, even since we probably last spoke on the stack, or is it still about great independent titles? Is it about other media? Where do you find really gets the creative juices from?
Inspiration personally or for the content in the magazine?
I guess for the magazine, but you can share your personal inspirations as well.
Content for the magazine, I think, comes from all sorts of places, not from other publications, definitely not. I think because we only publish twice a year, that would just mean doing something that has already been covered a lot. You know, we work with lots of brilliant writers and creatives, and it's normally just through conversations with them and a little seed of an idea, and someone says, oh, have you seen this documentary about this cult leader in LA that invented vegetarian restaurants or whatever it is? And then you find a book about it, and then you talk about it, and, you know, or a particular interesting person sort of reveals themselves as being incredibly interested in food and drink that you never knew about, and you feel like you have to
pay them a visit.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Fraser, that's interesting. How would you say, I don't know, in recent years, that the actual writing, particularly about craft beer, has come on? Because you've got Pete Brown, I think, is a contributor in this, who's pretty, I think, been on Monocle a couple of times. Very, very funny man. Brilliant writer. Has that really moved on in concert with how craft beer itself has moved on? There's a lot more writing and very good writing than there was even probably, 5 years ago?
Sure. Yeah, and there are people contacting us all the time wanting to contribute from different perspectives. And it's a topic that people are very passionate about and they enjoy writing about. And I think that shows on the page.
Now, I mean, I guess it's obvious. Yeah, people are passionate about beer. It's a lot of fun. True. They care a great deal. But it seems to connect in something different. Again, does it filter back to this idea? Because beer drinking is often, or hopefully mainly, you know, social pastime. Why are people so... Why has it garnered this extraordinary response around the world? Whether it's with beer business like yours or with magazines. What is it about it that's resonated so much, do you think?
I guess there is a whole kind of craft food movement in general. And that's part of it. But I think beer is an important part of the human experience. I think it's a big part of all of our lives, and for a long time people didn't drink beer that tasted of much, and now we're kind of discovering, wow, you can make all kinds of different beers, and I think that's exciting a lot of people.
Is there a risk, I don't know, Dave, do you have a view on this, that people think, so this is how you do it, you just put loads of hops in? Is there a risk that people kind of go off the other way and start to try and do too much? Because I've seen some pretty, let's say, esoteric combinations out there, or ingredients, and I've thought, you know, I don't really fancy that. Are people? Do you think people maybe go too far, or can you never go too far? Like with most things in life,
I think you can never go too far as long as you can always still get a cold, cheap pint of crap lager on a hot day in a dusty glass. You know, like no, variety is always good, isn't it?
Well, on that note, should we launch in next? What are you going to recommend, Fraser? I mean, we've got time for at least one more.
That's great.
Do we want to ease into that world of esoterica, or shall we?
Well, I don't know. I brought along a beer from Sweden that we imported from there, from Kapp Brewery over in Sweden. They are a really fantastic brewery.
Sounds not getting any less good each time it happens.
It actually sounds like a sort of Foley. Doesn't really sound real.
Maybe we could go into that. Oh, we've got a foaming glass
this
alert.
One's, quite lively, this one.
So what have we got here?
Someone may have dropped it somewhere along the way.
Porter or something.
This is an oatmeal stout. Ooh, so it's got nice chocolatey coffee notes. It's a very fantastic
beer. That's literally the sound of a foaming beer on the stack. I think a first.
In my mouth.
Whoa, that is foamy.
And we do receive we receive samples at our office every day. We're on the third floor. A poor postman has to carry these boxes of beer up the stairs every day.
Just make sure he doesn't receive this one. So this is Don't Break the Oat.
Don't Break the Oat by Cap Brewery in Sweden. It's an oatmeal stout. It's sort of chocolatey. It's like coffee notes.
It's very coffee.
Really great dark beer.
Mm, very caramelly.
Mm.
Quite significant head on this beer at the moment. We just have a quick sample. Yeah, mainly just that. There's not much beer in that one. But very good. That's a kind of, maybe more for a sort of wintry.
Sure.
A wintry
an
evening.
After dinner beer, maybe?
Yeah, well, nice. What we found is everybody
with a piece of pie or something.
Yeah. Everybody has different types of beer that they like, and our editor Erin, she loves when somebody says, I don't like beer, and they say, well, what kind of wine do you like, or what kind of food do you like, and then help them find a beer that they like, and there is a beer for everybody.
There is, and our lucky listeners can help to find those beers for themselves by having a look at Ferment Magazine, which is out now. We've got the next one within weeks, early in July
yeah,
as well.
The Danish issue is in stores just now.
Wonderful stuff. Well, Fraser, good luck with it. It's great to have you with us. Thanks for coming to talk to us. That's Fraser Doherty from Ferment Magazine and our good friend David Lane from The Gourmand. David, thanks for being
with us too.
When's our next Gourmand available?
Available in September. It'll be in all good magazine shops.
Well, perhaps we shall speak to you again on the stack then.
Do.
This is The Stack on Monocle 24. Now, we all enjoy a bite or two here at Midori House, but perhaps none of us quite so much as my next guest. Not because he's morbidly obese, but because he's the man behind the menu. On Monocle 24, it's Marcus Hippi. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for the kind words.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Now, we've been talking about food on the page, the printed page, magazines, this sort of thing. But, of course, it's hard to talk about food in print and not at least acknowledge the presence, the influence of, well, I was going to say the humble cookbook, but these days
they're not always
that humble
anymore.
And the variety, like with magazines, it's just astonishing, isn't it? How do you pick favourites when it comes to the books on page? Is it about photography? Is it actually about the chefs? Is it about a culture?
You know,
food?
Actually, I brought in a selection of my favourite cookbooks, and they all are my favourite cookbooks for different reasons.
Good.
So I suggest we go these through one by one. If we start from something more traditional, I think this one is a good example. This is by
The New Easy,
Australian Donna Hay. It's one of her
books. Good friend of ours, actually.
She's
here
released,
at Monocle 24.
Exactly. She's released loads of books, and that's what was it called? I forgot the name of the book already.
The New Easy.
The New Easy.
Wasn't that your nickname in high school?
No, it wasn't. What was your nickname, by the way?
People just called me Sir, because they were very respectful.
Right.
Back to Donna Hay's New Easy.
Anyway, Donna Hay...
And she's a bit of a past master. Simple classics, isn't it?
So basically,
honest food.
There are two reasons why I like that cookbook you have over there. It's very practical and it's quite easy. The instructions are very easy. And I see you glancing it through page by page. You see the photos are good. What I enjoy is that there's a very specific style to her photos in her magazine and in the book, photos, images as well. And I actually once asked her about that, and she said it's down to the Australian sun.
They use
a lot of natural light when they're taking those photos.
Here's a picture of Donna cracking a couple of eggs there. What's that in the background? Some kind of Bay Area? I don't know where. But it's beautiful. And it's true, I guess there's a different food sensibility depending on the climate, which is something that's very much telegraphed.
And that book, when you go through those images, it gives you a very fresh feeling. And
that's interesting, as by way of comparison, you've also got, speaking again to your own heritage, the Nordic cookbook.
From Australia to the Nordic region, I have the Nordic cookbook.
And is it more austere? Is it a bit cooler?
It's by Magnus Nilsson. And it's actually, this book is not particularly approachable. It's actually...
Again, it's like you, Marcus.
It's like a massive encyclopedia of what people have been preparing in the Nordic region.
Is it jam-packed with your sort of pickled sharks and this sort of thing? Or
exactly,
is it a bit more down-home?
Exactly. So this is why I like this book is that this is actually one of the very first of its kind. So Magnus Nilsson is the top chef from Sweden of Fäviken fame, and he set himself a goal to get to know the Nordic food culture and to write a massive encyclopedia almost.
He's
of
an amazing
what is going on
I'm
in a, the region.
I'm familiar with his work. I've not been to Favican, sadly, but pretty extraordinary.
Anyway, the result is about 750-page book that basically lists everything. I don't cook much from this book, but
and you finish
whenever
favorites
I need
there.
To check something from there, I can always find.
Let's have a quick browse.
There's an amazing selection of recipes over there. Yeah.
What about
Finnish karjalanpiirakka, Karelian?
I was going to say karjalanpiirakka.
Pies are there.
Do you agree with the recipe, or does the hippie family have any? Are there any secrets?
I think Finns are quite liberal when it comes to recipes, so we're not that stuck up about, you know, what's right and what's wrong, and you can do different things.
I'm not being funny, but I literally opened it.
And it's there.
And it's the Karelian
pies. I have probably been showing that page to quite a few people in the office already, so maybe that's the reason why it's.
Absolutely. Look at that delicious munavoi in there.
Yeah, do you like munavoi?
At times. Where should we go next, Marcus?
Let's continue then with something healthier. So I feel like everyone is releasing salad books now. Just look at that book. It's by David Bess, who's this Italian guy who moved to London from Milan quite a few years ago. And do you know what happened to him when he arrived?
What is salad
in the
pride?
UK? He gained a bit of weight. And to solve that issue, he decided to create a salad lunch for himself for 1 year. And basically what you see in that book is a collection of some of his favorite salad recipes. And if I explain what the book looks like, each page has a beautiful photo of a salad and then the recipe below. It's such a simple concept.
There's a beautiful simplicity to this.
Exactly. It's so simple and it's very easy as well.
Marcus, when you read books like this, do you always take a particular note of a particular recipe and think, I'm going to try that?
That's exactly what I do nowadays.
But then do you actually follow that through, or is it always an ambition?
I do follow through. I do. I actually sometimes spend quite a lot of time, money sometimes as well, trying to find the right ingredients. Some of them can be quite marginal in that book, so I've been kind of going to some of the greatest grocery stores in London,
looking for
something.
Salad Love, how to create a lunchtime salad every weekday in 20 minutes or less. Mm.
And then let's continue with another favourite book of mine. Just this proves that there is still innovation taking place when it comes to cookbooks. Such a simple idea, already the second edition of this book, Where Chefs Eat. What a great idea for a book.
You go to chefs and ask for
their own favourite restaurants, and the restaurants are not always high-end places. Sometimes they are really cheap. But, you know, chefs know about good food. So
if anyone's going to, it's going to be a chef.
Exactly.
And this is kind of, it looks a little, feels a little bit like a small, like a house brick.
It's a massive, massive
so
book, but it's surprisingly
it
light as well. So when you go on a holiday, Tom, with your handbag, you can put it there and it's not too heavy.
Marcus Hippie, many thanks for giving us your time here on The Stack. Don't forget to tune in to the menu premieres Fridays at 1900 London time on Monocle 24. Delve into the archive at our website or on your preferred platform. That is all we have time for this week. Thanks to Marcus Fraser and David Lane. Thanks to our producer Ben Ryland and our editor Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome. Get in touch via the usual channels, and don't forget to delve into the archive if you just can't wait another week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.